Oh, it fades it out. Hey.
It fades out. Okay, that was great. Look at that. Okay, that was fantastic.
I'm probably
going
to have to replace it, but whatever. Hey.
All right, how's it going? We're here. Welcome to the Now You're Playing This podcast. We're currently on, I don't even know what this program's called, Zencaster. So this is a...
We're doing a remote pod.
We're doing a remote pod. But this is the podcast where me and Weston, we read through the Nintendo Power magazines.
We
one volume at a time. Yeah, we love them. We can't
like
stop.
Like those sandwich chinchillas from the 2000s.
And yeah, we're currently on volume 54. We're in November 1993.
Secret of Mana.
We got a lot to talk about. But
and
today,
joining us today, we have a super special guest. It's our second game dev guest.
Ooh. This
is Carrie Patel is here all the way from Orange County, USA.
Hello. I'm great. Thank you.
Hey, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're excited to talk video games.
Thank you for having me.
So, Carrie, you were a novel writer. You're a novelist who moved into the world of video games. And your story is actually dramatized in the book Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which I found out after I bought it, in the chapter about Obsidian and Pillars of Eternity. So can you say what you're like? What's your role in games now?
Sure. So I started out as a narrative designer slash writer. Different studios define those roles differently, but basically writing story, character, and dialogue, starting with Pillars of Eternity 1, which is what I got hired at Obsidian for. I've been there for 10 years now, so I've worked on both Pillars of Eternity games, the DLCs for the first one, The Outer Worlds. I directed the first DLC for The Outer Worlds, Peril on Gorgon, and now I am directing Avowed. So I've gone from primarily writing to game direction and creative direction.
Yeah, so cool. We've been informed we can't ask anything about Avowed at all.
You
can only talk about old things.
We can't even acknowledge.
You can ask whatever you want. I just can't promise I'll answer it.
That's amazing. Yeah, thanks so much for being here. I've known you a long time. It's been really fun to see all the super cool games you're working on. And those are largely RPGs, right? So those are all RPGs.
Yeah, and that's,
if I'm not mistaken.
Pretty good list. Those are pretty fucking sweet games to have worked on. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought that was like a perfect fit here because our like kind of the game of the issue. See how do you like that segue?
Very nice.
The cover.
Yeah, this is volume 54, November 93. We're actually recording this in a November also, which is crazy. And the cover is Secret of Mana.
A legendary JRPG.
Legendary JRPG, which I've only ever played like the first 30 minutes of this game.
Yeah, I haven't really played much of this one either. It's because I know it's like the Super Nintendo is kind of like a pillar of like these... It's got like a lot of the best RPGs, at least for the time. It like was really like pushing that forward. And I know this is like one of the ones people point to as like, this is one of the great ones.
To say, y'all have more experience with Secret of Mana than I do. I probably should have disclosed this first, Weston, but we were a bit of a hybrid console family. So while our neighbors had the Super Nintendo, we had a Sega. So
you were a Sega family?
Well, okay, we were Atari, then original Nintendo, then Sega, Nintendo 64, and then my youngest sister got a PlayStation 2, which she was very generous in sharing with the rest of us. So, yeah, we a little bit of everything, except, like, GameCube.
Were any of those systems yours?
No, but I was probably the primary Nintendo 64 player for a while.
Hell yeah.
And PC, obviously.
Oh, really? Okay, so you played a lot of... Did you have, like, a... home console, did you all share one and it was like whoever had it,
yeah,
whoever was
basically
on it was the one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
my household was very much a like I was the one playing games, like I got a hold of the family computer and put games on it, no one else. Like there was some Tetris. My mom loves Bust a Move, famously Puzzle Bobble, and yep. But beyond that, like it was me playing Counter-Strike.
Yeah. I was just frustratingly spoiled, so we all had our own laptop and system and TV, and worked that way.
Nice.
I don't have a lot to say about the art on the cover, because I actually don't know what this dragon thing is, except it looks like you can ride it. It is a nice illustration.
Yeah.
But this, again, is... I mean, this is kind of on us, because as little as... I should have not played a ton of Secret of Mana. I always wanted to play it, because it's three player. Like, and
yeah, I mean, that's actually like, I was thinking about that because like this whole twist, like the cool thing about it is like you get to play with other people. It's multiplayer. But I just thought how unsufferable I'd be to like play with. If I was like the lead, we'd be talking to every person in the village. We would open every drawer. And like, I don't know if I want to like invite people on that journey.
But I don't even think we can get into this more when we get to the feature, but I don't think you have all three characters up top. You definitely just start with the guy when he goes and gets the sword in the forest. So you've got another hour or two before you get your second player, which is the girl character. And then there's the little forest nymph thing is the third one. So
yeah,
player two and three, which presumably are younger siblings, have to sit and wait for you to, to get their characters before you can do anything.
Oh, man.
Carrie, did you play, like, on the Genesis, were you playing, like, JRPGs similar to this, but the Genesis version, whatever those are?
You know, not really. So I came a little late to RPGs. I think that probably the first thing I played that was really an RPG, well, RPG adjacent, I guess, was the Sierra Quest for Glory series. And that was basically, like, an adventure game with a little bit of RPG built in, like, to the side. Okay. Yeah, so I got into them a little bit later. So I missed this entire genre, but I always thought they looked cool.
I never played Quest for Glory, but I played King's Quest and Police Quest. How close are those?
I feel like very similar in terms of, well, I mean, except maybe for Police Quest, I didn't really play much of those. But like in terms of, you know, kind of having a tone that was, you know, it's fantastical. It's got a little bit of humor, but it's not driven by the humor. You know, obviously, like you could look at different games in those series from the same era and recognize like the quality of graphics. And, you know, when you go from like text parser to, okay, this is at least the parser that freezes the action on the screen to now we're in point and click. So, yeah, I think if you'd played King's Quest, you would have been right at home in Quest for Glory.
Nice.
I was really not good at those games because I got a hold of a Commodore 64 at some point in my teenage years. So I went back and played Archon and a bunch of text adventure games, and I'm pretty sure that's how I got a hold of King's Quest and Police Quest. And those are games that really punish you for not doing everything right. It's like in Police Quest, famously, you go out to your car, and if you don't walk up to every side of you, you do your full walk around to the car and check every side, your car just flies into a wall and crashes when you drive it, and you die. Like...
The nice thing there, though, is at least your point of failure happens pretty soon after your mistake. I feel like the real challenge with those games is you could make a mistake and not discover until hours later that, and you wouldn't even necessarily know, like, have I not found the solution yet? Or did I screw myself over 2 hours ago? Like, I think in King's Quest V, you have to feed the bird something so that it doesn't die. And you could feed it a pie or like a leg of ham, but my God, you're going to need that pie for the Yeti when you get to the Snow Queen. And if the Yeti kills you, like how do you know if you don't have the thing that you need?
I mean, that's very like old. It's like one of my favorite games of all time, Planescape Torment. I got cursed that my character would burp nonstop. And there's only one guy who can like heal that, but I killed that guy. So I was just like, all right, well, for the rest of the game, my character just literally just burps. And it's like this gross, like, sound effect that I'm like, I guess I just have to deal with that from now on.
But you could at least finish the game. Just you're just burping the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the pro
it's
there.
It's just annoying.
Mailbox.
Okay, yeah. So we're on the mailbox where, like, you know, people, like, submit in. Often, like, readers submit stuff. I thought this one was kind of funny, too, because normally, like, readers submit, like, letters and like stuff for us to read. The like box around this one is people were like giving their opinions on Star Fox the game, which honestly, especially for this magazine, which is already like from a standpoint of propaganda, like they're only gonna like normally grab the positive things. These are like pretty divisive. Half of these are kids like saying like they don't like Star Fox. I'm shocked that they published this.
Yeah, Greg and Jeremy are kind of critical.
Yeah, they're pretty critical on it. I
was surprised by this. Yeah.
Looking back, I don't know. Cause again, I wasn't really like, I didn't get to experience the, like the event of 2D to 3D cause I was not born yet. But like, I always like fantasize this as this like shocking, like everyone's minds being blown. They're like, people are like running through the streets, but like these kids are like all just saying this looks shitty. They're all like, this looks terrible. I hate it. It's very funny to get like an underwhelming, like take on 3D.
I mean, so nothing's changed in like 30 years. Something new, shiny, amazing, and it's, you know, there's always a critic.
I think these are fair. I'm surprised nobody wrote in to talk about the voice acting of the game, because I remember Super Nintendo Star Fox was like the 3D stuff. It was janky, but I loved the music, and especially the fact that the characters are fully voiced in the ending cutscene only. So you finish the game and then it's like, wait, that's Fox. He's radioing in to say he's going home. That's crazy. And then the credits roll. And I was just like, that's so cool. Nobody talks about that.
Now, how close did he sound to what you'd heard in your head through the whole game? Was this like a retcon of how Star Fox sounds?
What was the Star Fox voice cue in the SNES game? Slippy was like, with ribbit. It's like rib, ribbit, rib, ribbit. And then Falco or somebody is like, bah, 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 bah. They just have like kind of vocal gibberish barks.
It sounded like the voice version of the gibberish.
Yeah, they switched over to like kind of a generic, like, this is Fox, mission accomplished. I'm going, it's just some guy.
Okay.
And then General Pepper is like, this is General Pepper. I don't know. I'm probably misrepresenting it. I did not listen to it again before this recording. So
then, they also, for some reason, people just submitted vacation photos. Didn't really have anything.
They brought their magazines on vacation.
I guess one of them, the kid's holding up a magazine, but the other one's just a generic vacation photo. I don't know why this was a section in it.
Yeah, they've got one open. They're just like sharing it, but it's...
Oh,
that's,
I didn't
at
notice.
Least that's
okay.
What it looks like. Yeah.
So it's just people who brought their Nintendo Power magazine.
I think a lot about the parents who took these pictures, where it's like, hey, kid, we drove you to the desert so you could see the Grand Canyon, and it's like, get a picture of me with the magazine, they'll put it into a future issue.
Yeah, and then we switched to, there's another section too for Mega Man, which is a thing that they did that I think at surface area I thought was really cool, but in execution it's not. They did a whole contest for context. They had a whole contest in an earlier Nintendo Power magazine where kids submitted their own version of like Mega Man villains.
Mm-hmm.
And their whole promise was they would get to include some of these in the game.
It's like backer characters before you had something like Kickstarter or Patreon.
Yeah, totally.
My Mega Man OCs.
Which I thought was really neat at the time, because like, I mean, to do that as a kid, to have like your idea get in the game would be so mind-blowing. But the only thing is they didn't really like grab anything from it. It's like the ones that won was like Windman, like a pretty generic name, and The actual like drawing of it has nothing to do with what the kid submitted. Like a kid submitted Windman and it's like this specific design. And the design that they like committed to has nothing to do with that. I'm curious on how you guys would also feel about that if you were a kid and you like drew this like Mega Man character and named it. And then they picked it and said, hey, we picked Brett's, or that we picked Carrie's, or we picked Weston's design. And they submitted it, but they literally changed everything. Do you think you'd still consider that a win as a kid? Or do you think you were like, God, I feel like I would take that as like a personal insult of like, that's not what I submitted. I'm mad at them for like claiming I did something that I didn't. Do you feel like you'd have a similar reaction, or do you think you'd be like, oh, this is just cool that I like got a thing into a video game?
I think I'd probably wonder, you know, you'd wonder what the original vision was lacking, because clearly they weren't quite seeing it. So it's like, okay, well, you like a part of this. Did you already have this idea sitting on the shelf, or... Where you're like, we can do this better.
I just think they're trying to like, those are game devs attempting to teach future game devs what to expect from the work. Like it's, you know, oh, I came up with this really great thing. And then by the time you see the final version, like, hey, if a little bit of that, your original thing makes it through, you did good. And that's just life, kid.
That's an excellent take.
I that's why I was also curious. I figured since you guys both have worked on video games, that would be more of, your reaction, where all of my creative stuff has been on my own and I get to do exactly what I want. So my reaction is very immature, like, God damn it, I wouldn't be okay with that. So I do think it's interesting that you guys probably have different perspectives on that. Of like, I mean, your reaction, Carrie, was really like, oh, that's a growth opportunity.
Yeah, look, the kid should be like, what did I get wrong that they didn't take my full idea?
Let's go to the drawing board. And then the only other thing I think is significant on this is during the editor's corner, which is like this little area where Gail Tilden, like the editor-in-chief, talks about stuff. She mentions kind of a very big collector's item, which is a Star Fox like competitive edition that is a thing you could only buy through the Nintendo Power magazine. And so the cartridge of this is worth like a couple $1,000s now.
So it's like, did you look up the recent prices? I didn't think to do that.
Yeah, it's like $4,000. So if you had gotten this, if you bought this game from the Nintendo Power magazine, you'd be sitting on $4,000 right now.
Oh wow, yeah, I'm looking at one of the auctions right now. One of them says $20,000. Oh, because it's evaluated. It's got the plastic thing with the number grade on it.
Yeah.
DK. All right, Secret of Mana. This game was so cool. Like I only played it a little bit, but like it's Legend of Zelda like. It's an action RPG. And it's got radial menus in it, which is super uncommon in 16-bit games where you pause and a circle of options comes around your character for using items or special skills or just general menu stuff. And then the three-player thing. And I actually ended up going down a bit of a rabbit hole, like more than we usually do on these games, reading about the production. And because this game had a complicated production, and I thought it... I just wanted to run some of these details by you guys. Do you know anything about like what happened with this game?
No.
So Squaresoft made Secret of Mana. This is the first Seiken Densetsu game, which is a RPG series that is much beloved that I am super not qualified to talk in detail about, but like Seiken Densetsu 3 never came out in the US. This game's a predecessor in some ways to Chrono Trigger. A lot of the same people worked on it. So, you know, and then the Mana series has continued into like the 32-bit era. And today, this game was a huge mess for so many reasons. This was going to be a launch title for the SNES CD add-on that Sony was making. And famously, when Nintendo snubbed them to go with Panasonic in like the middle of a press conference, Sony, of course, took their ball and went to go make the PlayStation. So they had to take a CD game, you know, with X hundreds of megs of content and cut it down to what Secret of Mana was. And turns out the game had branching stuff with multiple endings. It was honestly very much like Chrono Trigger. If you've ever played Chrono Trigger, it's famous for like how many endings it has. It's like 40% of the content cut. It was rushed to hit the holiday season. The English translation was a huge mess. Like it's a Ted Woolsey is like a famous translator. He also did Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger. He only had like a month to do Secret of Mana, and the text is mana spaced. So English text requires so much more space to say the same thing than Japanese does. So he had to cut out huge swaths of the story.
Oh no.
He also got Gary, you may appreciate this, he just got like the raw text out of order, like as if they just exported or printed a database and faxed it to him. So it's he said it was like shuffling a novel and handing it off to somebody.
Brutal.
I just like that's a very brief rundown of all the stuff this game went through in development. It just made me very some of those details I was like, yeah, this making things is hard.
It's weird that like, because like I know Final Fantasy VII also like was known for having a really bad translation.
The quality of translations has gotten a lot better recently.
Like people like retranslate it, and I guess just like we had lower expectations because it seemed like no one really like these games are still revered regardless, and it's sometimes like it's surprising to hear that like a game that's like, oh, this is known as like one of the best like games of that era was mistranslated, and that wasn't like dooming towards it, especially because this is like the whole thing is this like narrative though.
Carrie, have you come across, and again, you don't, if you can't say anything, of course don't, but like have you come across like situations like this where because of a deadline or something like that you had to pull something you really wanted to keep in a game, or technical issues? Or
I mean, I feel like that's the case with every game to some degree. Like you start out in pre-production with kind of these you know, pages of documents, all the things you're going to do, all the features you're going to have, all the content, you know, and over the course of time, you know, whether it's because of, you know, just having to get things done or realizing, hey, this thing that sounds great on paper doesn't work as well in practice, or this thing's a lot harder to build. We can have A or we can have B. Like, you end up, and in, I feel like most of the time those refinements lead to a better game. And it's really easy to look at the stuff you've cut as like, oh, well, you know, it would have been so much better with this. But I think what you end up getting most of the time is something that's a bit more focused. And like, I'd rather have, you know, something a little bit smaller where everything is fantastic than something huge and sprawling with everything, where you've got a lot of unevenness and quality. So,
My favorite conversation that I've had is when a level designer or somebody comes to you, an audio dev, and is like, what you want to do is bad, and here's why. And then you have to like break down, here's the tech, the engine limitations. Here's, you're not thinking about all the NPCs that are like running their cycles in the background of this scene. We can see like 8 different people. Think about the load that's going to put on this other part of the game, the scripting engine or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, like I really do. I wasn't joking. I really enjoy those meetings because, yeah, you want to be pragmatic and do the best thing you can. And like making it a horrible nightmare for another team is bad.
Yeah, I'm actually curious. I'm curious too, is like, because you went from like writing books where like, obviously there's, I'm assuming, no limitations really. You can just describe like, oh yeah, it's just bam, 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 we're there. And it's not like a lot of effort to anyone else. Do you feel like it took some adjustment of like, oh, I need to think of like how much work this is going to put onto the program, like the bandwidth, yeah, of whatever that is. Was, did that take some adjustment?
Yeah, a little bit, definitely. Like I remember working on the first Pillars game. There's this character named, I think it's Abrakan Domanel, who's like this really, you know, I don't know, this kind of pain in the ass son of this crime family. And I remember like kind of the first version I wrote of like his conversation, he, you know, he throws a fit, he throws his goblet of wine across the room, slaps someone. And then like my boss is reviewing this and he's like, hey, so play this, take a look. Like you see the character on screen, like think about the things he's doing in terms of like just a little cone or cylinder around him. Because, you know, one of the fun things about writing for Pillars was, you know, we could write description and gesture and all of that non-dialogue prose that I really enjoy writing in, you know, other fiction. But you still, there's a line between what the player can sort of imagine while they're seeing these characters on screen versus getting to a point where the action is so big that you're like, wait, I'm not seeing any of this. This doesn't make sense anymore. So we did kind of have to, you know, like you said, adjust into, okay, whatever's happening, whatever we're describing, it still has to fit with what we can show on screen.
Uh-huh.
Because I know I've done that where it's just like, you can't show, you just had this character hand 2 things to 2 other people in a seat. You can't do that. Like,
you have to animate that now. Yeah.
I had to go back to work on a scene that somebody else had written, like to do a revision on it, like an unfinished thing. And the original script had a bunch of like kind of scene work stuff with props and things, like at a bar where it's like, oh, they get a beer at the bar. And you go look at the finished scene and it's like, well, they couldn't do that. So nothing happens. The character just kind of stands there and it's like, oh, like it's all on the page, but you just can't. So I had to like cook up new business for them to do that, you know, worked within those confines. Same thing.
Nice.
There is one little bit of a good detail that came out of this game that was not planned, and that was the 3-player multiplayer thing.
Oh, shit,
they did
really?
Not wasn't... know it was going to be. And I was just watching some stuff about entities, like a Godot engine tutorial the other day, and it kind of makes sense how that might have happened, because these other your companion characters in the game would have had the same rule set. They have hitboxes, they have hit points, they have the ability to choose actions to take and stuff. And you can, there's like this grid system where you can program them in a very basic way for how to behave in fights. So probably at some point they were like, oh, we could just hook a player input up to this character and they just work.
Yeah, that's super cool.
It feels like a really early version of what, you know, like games like Baldur's Gate 3 and Divinity Original Sin do, where you've got this sprawling RPG. And I think, Brett, what you were describing is, you know, how do you get player interests aligned? If you've got one person who wants to follow the story very closely, you've got another person who just wants to cause mayhem and kill things. And the other one who's like, you know, stealing from every merchant and getting the rest of your party in trouble.
Yeah. One other thing too that I do want to call out about this game is that I love is when you fast travel, you don't just like appear and reappear somewhere. You shoot out of a cannon. And I really like the idea of justifying fast travel in like a creative, like in an in-game logic way.
Nice.
I'm in. I'm so down for that.
More features.
Yes, Cement.
The next game is
did not know this game existed. It seems crazy and awesome. It's called SimAnt. You know, they had SimCity, and then they moved to SimEarth. And now they zoomed in as much as they can into SimAnt, which is like it's like an ant simulator. It seems like it's kind of a hybrid between like almost like a war game almost. There's two types of modes, it says. There's one called Ant versus Ant, and you're like ants like battling each other. And the other one's called like House Takeover, and you're a bunch of ants trying to like take over a house. Carrie, you said you seemed like excited. Are you excited because you read this and you're like, this is a really interesting, weird game, or have you played this before?
I was extremely into SimAnt when it came out when I was young. I love this
Amazing.
Game. Yes. Yeah, I played it on PC. We had a handful of the Sim games. Like we had Sim City. We had Sim Farm, which my sisters and I also liked. We would always try to raise horses, but really crops were more profitable, just less interesting. Eventually there was The Sims, but best one was always SimAnt. Such a fun game. And yeah, you're right. Like you have the kind of this campaign. You're trying to build up your ant colony, but also prevent the red ants from taking over the yard first. So it's, you can kind of focus on like one patch of the yard or house at a time, build up your colony, eliminate the red ants, and then you can like spawn new queens and continue spreading your ant colony around the yard and eventually into the house. And it was always really,
The squares are like war zones. It's like, this is like a war zone. Like, who has control of this square? Who has control of this square?
Exactly.
Cool.
This sounds so good.
I do want to tee up how funny it is that we had Carrie Ann, who like writes on a lot of the best like RPGs. We're like, oh, she's going to love Secret of Mana. That's like...
She's like, never played it. Didn't even have a Super Nintendo.
Nothing to say as soon as we're on SimAnt. She... Is there a multiplayer aspect to it? Like, would you go against your sisters in like a campaign mode, or was it just playing by yourself and you would like have to like just beat the red ants?
I don't remember if there was a multiplayer mode. I played against the computer. So yeah, you could. I don't know that anyone else in my family had the same passion for SimAnt, to be honest.
I get that. I'm a Sim Tower guy and nobody cares but me, but I love Sim Tower.
I don't know why. It just, I'm usually not that interested in the Sim games, like Sim City, Sim Earth, boring. SimAnt, I am so interested. This seems so fucking cool.
It was fun because there were a lot of different things you could do, and the game made it really easy, I think, to toggle between different activities. Like, you could sort of pick, you could choose to control any one of the, like you're playing the black ants, so any particular ant you wanted. And so you could dig tunnels for your queen and food storage and for more eggs to be laid. You could take on a soldier ant and just literally go fight ants. You could take on a worker ant and start bringing little food pellets back to your nest. So yeah, you have a lot of options.
This honestly seems cool. I mean, are you building like a little base too? Like when you're like digging around, are you like
you're just kind of digging out. Yeah, so you've got kind of the yard. Well, there are like three different views as I remember. There's kind of the full yard strategic view where you can see what all the squares are and who has control. Yeah. Then there's the I'm in my square and I'm crawling around on the surface where you can see like enemies, like you'll have spiders,
so
the red
like
ants.
Top down
food.
View almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then if you go into your little ant hole, you have kind of like that ant farm kind of cross-section view where you can just kind of see it's like two-dimensional and you've got kind of, you can dig down, you can dig across.
Like a side view. It's kind of like the game Worms.
Exactly. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You know, it's wild that different tiers of views and stuff, like I think in the modern day you would call that a colony sim. Like ant colony. Ha ha ha. But like, yeah, I mean, it sounds like RimWorld and Dwarf Fortress. Like, it sounds like those games. Even if those might be like way crazier, you know, you can't have vampire cats in this game, but you can in Dwarf Fortress. I love that this game lets you use the mouse. Like, it's Carrie, you played it on PC, right?
Yeah.
So it feels like you need a mouse for this game to work. Playing this with a controller sounds terrible.
Yeah,
I'm not. I think on the level of controlling an individual ant, you could use the controller, but once you get to like menu navigation and switching up which ant you're looking at and kind of scrolling around the world and managing your different views, that does seem more like a mouse good mouse function.
Do you still prefer like mouse controls over like controllers, or have you switched?
It depends on the game. Probably a little more comfortable with mouse and keyboard, but we have an Xbox and a PlayStation at home, and my husband play a lot on the couch, and I both play a lot on the couch together. So
yeah,
I've gotten used to that too.
All right, well, this game rules. I love it.
And then there's a section on Arrow the Acrobat, but more importantly, this is the other side of the
centerfold.
It's the centerfold. It's Batman the Animated Series. This is an ad for the Game Boy game, which, okay, but like more importantly, Batman the Animated Series is really good.
Oh yeah?
Millennials everywhere love it. Specifically me. And its spin-off shows. Like Superman the Animated Adventures and the Batman Superman Adventures.
Was
and
this
Batman
like
Beyond?
Was this like Justice silly League. Animation? Was this like was it like cool? Like was it like cool and serious, or was it like fun and silly type of Batman?
It was like surprisingly serious and frequently super dark. Like there's a famous when I got my 3DO interactive multiplayer in the 90s, instead of buying a PlayStation, I got a 3DO because Andy had one and I didn't have any common sense as a child. It came with a demo disc, and the first part of the first Mr. Freeze episode is on there. And that it's like kid friendly. Nobody gets like murdered, but it is not, it is dark. It's him deeply upset about his Mr. Freeze deeply upset about his dead wife. And then he like leaves one of his henchmen for Batman to capture. And the guy's like panicking, and like, it's just super dark. Like the show rules.
All right.
Good writing. Really good writing.
Master's Adventures.
We don't really care anymore, I don't think.
Go check out our Howard Nestor retrospective a couple of episodes back if you haven't. We got like a yarn board, a conspiracy board with all the yarn, and we got like way too in deep analysis. This is just a comic about Star Wars.
Yeah, we used to have a fun game where we like overanalyze it as like a game to kind of make it more fun to read, like read way too into everything as if it's like a serialized story they're telling. But we're just done. We don't care. How do you feel reading this? Do you feel like you would skip this section as a kid, or do you feel like it's like, oh, a comic book, I'm excited?
I probably would have read through it, and then I remember We rented the Nintendo Empire Strikes Back game a few times, and reading this, I'm like, I want to give that another try and see if I can get farther than Hoth, because I never got out of Hoth.
That game was janky.
It made you want to play the game. Okay. Yeah. Like it's kind of worked.
I will say the art in this one is better than a lot of them. This was done by a guy named Dan Spiegel. I don't know if the others were, but his signature is super clear in this one. It's actually a pretty legendary comic artist. So,
oh, really?
Dan, wherever you are in the great beyond, I'm sorry we disparaged your comic art and the other Nestor comics you did. this one's solid. His Luke Skywalker is totally fine. Like, it's totally good.
Yeah, it's fine.
Also, great news, I guess the comic ends in 1993, so it's either this issue or the next one, and it stops.
Really?
We're almost done. We've almost made
it. Oh my, that is some good news, because I am absolutely sick of this section. Okay.
Let's take a break.
Hey, you're listening to the Now You're Playing With Podcast, the podcast.
Are you ready?
This is the beer break brought to you by Howard and Nestor.
Hey, I'm Nestor. Glub up that beer. My friend.
Here we go!
In a peaceful land, paradise is threatened by an unspeakable evil. And only one person has found the power to restore perfect order. In a new action-adventure game for your Super NES comes an exciting tale, The Secret of Mana, from Square, maker of the world's greatest video games.
All right, let's get back to the guys.
Because, hey, we're back. Over the break, we were talking about player feedback.
I mean, just to hear you say, like, you go through great pains to make sure that doesn't happen, it's cool that, I mean, I know you don't like that you're going through the pains of that, but it is cool that, like, developers know. Like, that's pretty important, and it's cool that you're.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It just seems like it's a thing that game can't like disappear. It's like that's a thing you don't, just don't expect to like run into it in a game. But it kind of goes underappreciated, probably how much work it actually takes to make sure stuff like that doesn't happen when like a game's being a little what feels like to be a little unfair to you in a moment.
Just for the listeners, really quick, we were talking about how. I don't even know if this is going to make it in the final recording, but we were talking about old adventure games, like the Quest games, King's Quest, Police Quest, how they'll punish you. And it also made me think of Shadowgate, which is the same way. Shadowgate will kill you super fast for picking up the wrong thing or going to the wrong place or using the wrong item. But it's always a quick punishment as opposed to, so you understand you made a mistake. And that's, so it's actually a conscious design thing, even though it feels kind of antiquated now. And that blew my mind, because even though that feels very obvious, it never occurred to me. Yeah. And the thing that popped into my mind just now, talking about player feedback, is I feel like branching dialogue and player choices are a place where some games get it really right, where they kind of teach you to understand how to think about a choice. But I still will play things all the time, both like indie and big, where it's just like, you're in a room. This guy's like, we need to make a choice now. And it's four things. You're like, I don't understand what any of these do. Like, I don't understand. So you just kind of pick one randomly to see what'll happen, I feel like, is how the choice occurs.
Yeah, I feel like one thing that always you want to establish early, and like as a player, I always feel kind of stressed about until I know the rules of the game I'm playing.
Yes.
Is which choices are going to materially affect something, and which yeah. choices are just for me to role play a little bit. Like, I think every yeah. game has, yeah. most games have at least some, they give you some idea of time pressure, and it's usually artificial because, you know, they want the experience to feel urgent, but they don't want to rush you through the game. But like something like Deus Ex Human Revolution, that very first tutorial mission, not the tutorial mission, the one after the tutorial where you're infiltrating right. that plant, like the first mm-hmm. quote unquote real mission.
Yeah, like, there's like hostages in the
yes,
in like a warehouse yeah. or something. Yeah, I remember that.
And they'll tell you, hey, get to the, like, get your comms fixed and then get to the chopper. We don't have a lot of time. And if you don't know that that really does matter, you can screw around for a long time in yeah. the Seraph Industries building and get all the hostages killed before you're ever on site. So like, how do you tell yep. players this matters and it's really okay, take your time? Like, that's always a fine line.
Yeah, to yeah. so interesting. That even sometimes reminds me of like when it's like, which door is going to go towards like that extra treasure chest?
Yes,
which door is
yes. going
to bring me into the next story beat?
Yes.
And being like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Jurassic Park. This
video game.
This Super Nintendo Jurassic Park game is super moody. That's all I have to say about it, really. It's It doesn't have the cool soundtrack of the NES game. It doesn't have the cool orchestral soundtrack and the voice acting of the sequel game that makes no sense. Jurassic Park 2, The Chaos Continues. I never played the Sega Genesis games, so I don't know how it compares to those.
It does have surround sound. I didn't know you could do surround sound with Super Nintendo games, but you got that.
It's got those Wolfenstein 3D levels where you go inside places and you're wearing like night vision goggles, which is super cool.
I think I played this for like an hour at a babysitter's house when I was a kid, and I remember not making it very far.
Yeah.
Remember the raptors would come out of the trees? Like, they would kind of stampede at you from the trees really fast.
There were always yeah. more raptors than I could deal with.
Yeah, well, I've never played it. Do you ever like want to like chase nostalgia in that way? Like, you're like, oh, I played this for an hour once as a kid. Does that make you want to play it? To be like,
sometimes
oh,
like, I yeah. yeah like I and I know you can find a lot of emulators now where you can get like, you know, 500, you know, classic Nintendo or Super Nintendo games, and I feel like I've jumped into those a few times and I'll play around a little bit and it's never quite what I remember, or it's neat to yeah. be like, oh, what a novel experience, nice to go back in time. But I've never spent much time in those games when I've gone back.
It's never as long as you think you're going to, like, oh, I'm going to yeah. finally, I'm yeah. going to replay Earthbound. No, you're not.
Yeah.
All right. You had a Sega Genesis. So it's like, I wanted to ask if you played any of the Phantasy Star games, but again, I think you said you came to RPGs later.
The one that I still feel like would hold up, but I've never put this to the test, is Mario 64.
That game
feel like that
still
was
good.
Still...
It holds up. I've replayed yeah. it.
Super Mario World. Also,
Ocarina of Time doesn't really that much, but I still enjoy playing it. But I do replay that in Mario 64 every once in a while. Just that's kind of like one of my deepest like nostalgia games. And Mario, like it feels really good to play still.
Mm-hmm.
The castle of Mario 64 still feels like a magical place for whatever reason. Yeah. I don't know. Something about like the old graphics, it makes it feel very dreamlike in a way that's really cool.
And there are all these nice little secrets hidden within it. Like, I remember there's that one skylight that you look up into, and then there's all the stuff in the basement and like the rabbits you have to catch.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a second flavor of what you guys are talking about with nostalgia, which is discovering a thing from back in the day that you missed. Like for me, the original XCOM UFO Defense, I did not play in the 90s when it came out, but circa like 10 years later, like 2004, 2005, became one of my favorite games. And I was obsessed with it. It's actually very simmy because you can do full destruction of environments and like you get really minute control over your soldiers and everything is super deadly and you name them after your friends and they all get killed and horribly by aliens. That game was amazing. And yeah. I found it later, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. I like when I played Planescape, which I talked about earlier, was because I had no gaming systems for a bit and I only had my PC. So I was like, I'll go like play some of those like older games. And I definitely would not have finished it if I had like a shiny PS4 to play at the time. But since I didn't have that option, I was kind of like forced to like sit down and go through the whole thing. And I'm really glad I did.
It's classified information. Cheat codes.
Yeah, so it's just the cheat code section. I want to bring up a few cheat codes. A game we talked about earlier was Evo. It was like a game where it's kind of like you like start off as like a little like amoeba and you slowly like evolve into like a bigger creature as you go.
Apparently, give yourself a better mouth, a better tail, faster legs.
Yeah, and you can eventually, a big thing is you can eventually turn into a human. And apparently, we talked about that, but apparently after a human, you can evolve into a mermaid. That's awesome.
What?
I think that's super sick. Yeah, late game, if you want to play the long game on Evo, you can eventually become a mermaid, which I think is super sick.
I would have played it just for that.
And then...
But can you become like a land mermaid, which would be, I guess, a centaur or something? Like, could you have horse legs instead of a tail?
Like, because, yeah, that's when we were talking about the game, it felt like you'd become the human and that's like end game. You're like, you're a human. That's the end of the game. But apparently, yeah, it sounds like you continue to evolve past that, which I actually think is like a fun extra flavor to it.
Evo's not about it does the reverse of evolution where it's like you become like it starts out as Darwinian evolution and becomes magical later. It becomes like the Greek pantheon or something. Or it's like you're a wing man. You're a human can fly.
And then there's also in Bomberman, there's like a cheat code where you can type in a code and you turn into a, like your character turns into like a little dot, turn into like a little tiny pixel Bomberman. Very much feels like I love like whenever games have like big head mode or any like just random bullshit of just something silly for no reason. Mm-hmm. I love that shit. And so Super Bomberman had that apparently.
Awesome.
And then in Zelda, they talk about how you can steal from the shopkeeper, which
is the Andy Petruzzo episodes of this podcast. I think he brings it up every time he's on. I mean, cause his favorite thing was stealing from the shop and then the shopkeeper kills you with lightning.
I mean, that was the thing about like Nintendo games. Like it's really shocking how many of these like old Nintendo games have like so many of these games have like a moment that's so distinct to me. Like, and Mario jumping like over the blocks and going to those tubes at the end where you do like that thing where you're like, your character's like walking through the scoreboard. Like you're way higher than what you thought the ceiling of the game was. And like being in a Zelda where you can like steal. Like, I don't know, just like all these games have like, or like Mario World and going to that fucking crazy Star World place. It's just like they all, like, they're so good at like giving you like one thing that was just fucking awesome. Like, it really sticks with you. And I think stealing is one of those things.
Has anybody here played Mario Wonder yet?
No. Oh, yeah.
You have? Awesome. Okay, yeah. Don't tell me anything about it. I just want to know, is it crazy?
Yeah, it's really good. I really, really liked it. I mean, I think the big sell, like, so every time in Mario Wonder, if you grab like a Wonder Flower, the whole level changes, and the second level turns into a musical. Like all the piranha plants start singing, and like a musical number, like a text as if it's a musical song, like appears up, and like all the characters are dancing and singing. If you kill the monster, like that vocal track is gone from the song.
What?
Yeah, it's that's the second level. It's the game's awesome.
That's kind of dark.
Yeah, no, it's pretty brutal, but very cool.
That is really cool. So do you find yourself like then when you just trying not to kill anything and just trying to run peacefully through the level so you can keep their music going. Song. Yeah.
That's kind of what I did, yeah.
Hope that Switch 2 comes out next year. That would be a great thing to play Super Mario Wonder on now that I don't have a Switch anymore. Star Fox comic. So, Carrie, you didn't go back and read all these other Star Fox comic issues, did you?
I did not. I'm jumping in the middle.
This is the fourth or fifth time it's ended, but not really.
Yeah, this exact scene has happened multiple times where they just keep killing like the main villain of Star Fox, Andross, and then we saved the day, and they go back to their like woodland hometown. All the woodland creatures are like singing a song and like throwing a parade for them, and then someone gets a call like, "Oh, Andross is still alive." That's happened like three or four. It's crazy. It just keeps happening.
So at the very end of the last comic, Andross got stomped on by a monster or something. He was in a little pod zooming around and got crushed. So now they're celebrating him being killed, but that was a clone. And there was two Andross clones.
So that's the one thing they've been doing over and over again. The other thing that's like weird about this comic is they just really laser focused on the fact that Fox's love interest, Farrah, looks exactly like his mom. And they just consistently
spent a lot of time talking about that.
They weirdly just consistently keep bringing that up.
Wow.
That's what this has been. It's been a wild ride.
So a guy dressed like Mario is making a statue of Team Star Fox to memorialize them for saving the galaxy three or four times now, because it'd be one less than the new threat. And then Andross is alive. Yeah, because there was two clones and one. No, because there's two Androsses here. So they have a fleet, and the fleet launches for not Corneria, but Papatoon, which is Papetoon. I don't know the Sherwood Forest place where the Star Fox characters are, because this is making me think of the Disney Robin Hood film. General Pepper warns them, and I'm going through it fast because I'm so confused. They've done this several times before. Pepper radios them and is like, a fleet is about to come blow. They blow up the statue. Like a warship comes, and then they blow up two of the five R-Wings.
Yep.
And so Falco, Pepe, and Fox run for the other R-Wings to take off. And then one or more Androsses is upset because Farrah looks like somebody named Vixie.
Which is us, which is Fox's mom.
Is that Fox? Okay, that's, so that's yeah.
Fox's so they're mistaking Fox's love interest as his mom. So apparently they look identical.
It sounds like Andross and Vixie had a thing in the past too. Maybe that was one-sided. I don't know.
Yeah,
I guess we'll find out in the next one.
I think the next one's the exciting conclusion.
There was a previous issue. So Farrah comes back to their hideout, and Fox has his mom's dress in a glass case, and she puts it on. And they're all like, "You look so much like her." And it's got, at the time, it felt like this comic was like the wish fulfillment was, it's very mom centric. It's very much like, this is for an 8-year-old boy who loves his mom. And romance is also mom centric. It's weird.
Yeah.
Someone's working through something.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much it. Did you have any takes reading this like fresh into it with fresh eyes?
I'm lacking a lot of context.
Yeah. But yeah.
I will say it looks like there are two Androsses at the end of this one too. One's just wearing red and the other's in green. I don't know.
Yeah, did the cloning happen before or after the, you know what? I mean, I'm not gonna look it up, and I don't think anybody here is, so we don't need to go into it. I still love the art in these. I think the illustrations are beautiful.
Yeah, I stand by the art's awesome. Story is I'm not invested anymore. That's, I mean, I'm just so bummed out that all the comics in this magazine suck. I just I was really excited about these.
It wasn't always this way.
No, I like the Mario one a lot, but otherwise, like I've been frankly a little disappointed. I thought this was gonna be like an exciting part, but
these comics for children are just not cutting it. But we all know, thanks to Bluey and Avatar The Last Airbender, that there are things that are good, legitimately good cartoons and stuff. It's possible to have something for children that's also like totally great.
I mean, it sounds like they just needed to invent a new threat and commit to it.
It's a very clean criticism. It's absolutely.
That's what we've talked about in this whole thing when we were just talking about, like, they just don't commit to anything. They have like little moments where they do something. We're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then it just goes away.
They wrapped up the original. And I think this one's been going since the start of 1993. So this is like issue 11. I feel like the first six issues, they just did Star Fox 1 as a story. And then it just kept going. And maybe it was totally that, where it's like, they just don't know what to do after the main story is over, so they just are kind of,
or it's like when loose. Game of Thrones the show got past Game of Thrones the novels, and they're you're trying to figure out what happens next.
They're just waiting for the next Star Fox game to come out.
Yeah, there's these like little half measures, but they keep coming back to Andross, which is this is not the only franchise to do this when it needs more story, like where it just really struggles, and they're trying to find interesting stuff. Like, I mean. The Pharaoh Mom stuff is super weird, but this is them attempting to add something to the story. And Fox's dad is in a space whale. And so there's like other. Yeah, we didn't even. Carrie just made a very shocked, confused expression, which is it's fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this will be concluded next time. So there we go. Yeah, so this is like, they're giving us like kind of a first glimpse on, I'm assuming you guys might know more about this piece. I don't even know what SGI is versus CGI, but it's like some other, there's, right, the short of it is like there's some like technological innovation and we can do 3D now. And they're kind of going into like they're showing us like kind of like early screenshots of the Nintendo 64 and like what that is capable of doing. They don't like announce like this is the 64, but they're mentioning like, hey, we're working on a 64-bit video game system. And they're showing all these images of the capability there. And I mean, for the starters, the images are really cool because they are all like...
It's like all early computer generated, like Pixar before Toy Story era, like yeah, technology. So everything looks kind of plasticky, but like it does still look neat.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's the showcase of the early stuff. But what I thought was really interesting was all of these images of like these early like CGI models, I felt like were all really related to the first games that come out with the Nintendo 64. The first games were Mario 64 and Pilot Wings. And a lot of these like photos of the renderings are big rooms with the big portraits in them. And they very much have like a Mario 64 vibe, even though it's not Mario 64. And the other photos are a lot of like vehicles, which is Pilot Wing. So it kind of feels like very, very, before those games probably were even like in the form, it just felt like they were just like making cool planes, making cool portraits. And it kind of like this, I just, the correlation is really, I don't know what that means, but the correlation there is really interesting to me.
I just want to say, like, before we talk too much more about the article, the layout of this article is one of the most 1990s looking things I've ever seen. It's got kind of like a faux marble background with like text with a drop shadow on it. It's got that font that's like in every cyberpunk.
Like Lawnmower Man font or something?
Yeah, the Lawnmower Man font. Thank you. it's extremely like early to mid 90s, and I love it. They've done a couple of these before because they did one about how cool CDs are when they were going to do the CD add-on with Sony. And then they did another one later that were like, CDs are bad, actually, when that deal fell through. And now they're talking about how good computer graphics are because they're like, instead of pre-rendered stuff, we're going to do all this stuff in real time. And Brett, to your question, Silicon Graphics was a company that built really, really high-end workstations for doing computer graphics for like movies and stuff.
Oh yeah, because they mentioned in this article like that this same technology was used for like movies and the medical community for like bodies and stuff, and which is also just like it's interesting that like this technology that like I mainly associate to video games was bigger than that, and that this is a part of like a bigger like. There's like it's interesting how like technology can develop in a different corner, but then it affects another place, which is happening here. So I just think it's cool.
Somewhere I heard somebody, I think it was a game dev talking. It might have been a VFX person in movies that talked about like the biggest changeover that happened in computer graphics was going from these super expensive workstations to like Windows PCs and like software that could run on a normal computer. Yeah. I mean, a really powerful normal computer. But like back in the day, you'd have to buy like a $75,000 computer, you know, to do this stuff. And so it was the very gatekept, like to be able to do computer graphics and modeling and animation. So I don't know. Yeah, this is where it came from. This is how we got Killer Instinct in Donkey Kong Country.
All right. Anyone got anything else on it? Or... yeah, that's about it.
They do. They mention the 3DO by name.
Hell yeah.
In a bad way. They're like, it's $700, which, yes, it was too expensive. Nobody, but it played, you know, it played Night Trap. It played Star Control 2 with voice acting. There you go.
I mean, it is like, I'm so shocked at like just looking at the past of like the difference between prices. Like one video game can cost like $200. A system could cost like $100. A system could be $700. Like it felt like prices were like all over the place. It was pretty crazy.
Do we need to have the 3DO talk, y'all? We can do it really quick. This could be really short. The business model of the 3DO was super weird because it was the 3DO company designed the specs of the hardware but did not sell hardware themselves. And they basically charged very, very, it's like a $10 licensing fee per game sold. So that sounds good on paper because it's like you can have all these manufacturers, Panasonic and Gold Star, make their own 3DOs and sell them. And then we'll take anybody can put a game out on the 3DO, which is how you got all of the shoddy adult content and like all the weird stuff, but also some cool ports of PC games that wouldn't otherwise have existed because they couldn't afford like normal console stuff. The problem is if you're not subsidizing the cost of your hardware with the licensing fees you charge or the you're selling cartridges to Capcom or whoever, you have to charge full price for those consoles so that the company can make a profit on them. So a $700 3DO is what you get when like you would have paid that much for a Nintendo, you know, a Super Nintendo or a Nintendo 64 if they weren't making the money back with those other revenue streams.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And there are plenty of low view count YouTube essays about this subject if you want to go down that rabbit hole.
All made by Weston.
yes. All watched by Weston.
Player pull contest.
Hey, so they're gonna send you to the NHL All-Star game in Madison Square Garden. Actually, that I'm not a huge hockey guy, but that seems all right.
Watching hockey's awesome. That's a fun sport to watch. There's just so much.
It's like soccer, but different in similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so we're at the it's me. So we're at the top 20. So these are like it's like the scoreboards. It's kind of like the leadership of like what games are selling the best, what games are like the most popular. And so we normally just rattle off the top three. So at the Super Nintendo, the top three games are at number three, Star Fox. At number two, The Legend of Zelda: The Link to the Past. And the number one, Street Fighter 2 Turbo.
Oh, can I just say, hey, the reviews for Secret of Mana, I forgot to mention this during that feature. A lot of people dunked on Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past by saying Secret of Mana was a better game with the multiplayer different mechanics and how big it was by comparison.
Brutal.
Take that, Legend of Zelda. Yeah. Carrie, do you want to do the Game Boy games? Just top three?
Sure. At number three, we have Kirby's Dream Land. At number two, Legend of Zelda: Link's Awakening. And at number one, we have Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins.
Yeah.
All right. NES games to round it out. Number three, Legend of Zelda. Number two, Super Mario Bros. This is the same, like, it's the same franchises on all three consoles. Yeah, the NES and Game Boy, they're just in different order. And then number one, Kirby's Adventure. What a fun little game to close out that system's life.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
It's very cute. Good animation.
Did you have abilities in that one, or were you just Kirby?
Yeah, that was the Game Boy one. You didn't
have abilities. That one. You can suck people up and turn into them.
Yeah, and the best one was the UFO power. That one was, ooh. I think you only had a couple spots where the UFOs would show up.
Okay, and then you can like free, like, can you fly when you're a UFO and like go wherever you want?
Yes. Yeah, you can fly, yeah. And I think you shoot lasers, so
good mobility. That laser's very good.
Yeah. I think that could get you into like some secret areas too, that could get you past particular obstacles.
I think the sword in Kirby's Adventure is so satisfying.
It is.
Like that, the it's got the Strider rules where the swish is like longer than the sword is. It's just this like blur in front of you.
Yeah. I'm a wheel guy. I like being the wheel and just the wheel's good. Zooming across the level.
Oh, yeah. You had to be
which
careful.
Kirby
though.
Power up are you?
I know. Yep. It really didn't go well. I was just, it constantly killed me, but it was just too fun not to do it.
Is there a Kirby game that's like actually difficult? Because Kirby's Adventure is super fun, but it is very easy. It's for babies. That's what I'm saying.
I remember Kirby 64.
I played it as a
being,
teenager.
Kirby 64 was a little challenging, at least as a kid.
Carrie, did you go to that GDC talk about the Kirby game? Like the HAL Labs? That one's online now. The line was too long, so I didn't go, and it's all just their design, the design problems they solved for the 3D for Kirby in the Forgotten Land.
That sounds fascinating.
It's so good.
You're creating a character who can adopt all these different powers and then trying to predict how they'll be used. Is that the core of it?
Yeah, I remember. So it was a lot of it was translating. This is on YouTube, so anybody can watch this. Just search for like GDC Kirby and you should be able to find the talk. And it's HAL Labs developers talking about working on the game. And it's super charming because Kirby is joy and delight. The stuff that I remember, the camera was a little bit interesting because it's like it's a 3D camera, but you're generally going left to right on stages that might have some depth to them. So you're like moving into the background or the foreground a little bit, kind of Crash Bandicoot rules sort of. And then the other thing that was really interesting was the targeting system they built for when you shoot a star at an enemy in 3D space. Because how do you know what the player wants to hit? Because it's never where they're actually pointed. Because that's how 3D works. So it's a lot of like kind of they had some targeting rules that they figured out that I found really fascinating. But it's definitely in the weeds.
I was looking at some of the games into the future. I remember both Super Nintendo and Sega had two different Aladdin games.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
I used to play the Super Nintendo one at a friend's house, and then because we had a Sega, we had the Sega version at home.
Are they completely different, or are they just like relatively the same game with some changes, or is it like a just completely different game?
They were pretty different. I think the big thing was in Sega, you had a sword, so you were actually fighting back. I don't remember what your combat mechanic was in the Super Nintendo version.
You threw apples and jumped on guys.
Oh, yeah.
I played a lot of the Super Nintendo one, except when I was at a friend's house and I'd play the Sega Genesis one.
That would be so frustrating to be like, in my game, I throw apples, but in my friend's game, you have a sword.
It's like a scimitar.
Yeah. I mean, the apples actually feels truer to Aladdin. He seems like a non-lethal kind of guy. But,
that's a good point. I mean, that's
an excellent
Aladdin,
point.
But it felt nice to have a sword.
It's very indicative of like the vibe of the respective consoles in that era, because Sega was trying very hard to be a little more grown up edgy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, let's give him a sword. Does he have a sword in the movie? No. He doesn't
at
all.
People? No, he doesn't. But you will in this game.
He doesn't even kill Jafar because he traps him as a genie. Like, he's one of the few Disney villains to not totally die at the end of the movie.
Do Disney villains normally die at the end?
Well, think about, like, in that era, let's see. Ursula gets,
dies.
She gets impaled by a boat.
Gaston dies.
Gaston falls off the castle, right?
Yeah.
After he stabs Beast. And then
Scar dies.
He gets torn apart by the hyenas.
You're right. Aladdin is kind of unique in that regard.
Well, since we're in the Pack Watch, let's talk about Flashback. Briefly. Flashback is great. It is a semi-sequel to Out of This World. It's a very important game to me because it was one of the first 16-bit games with like cutscenes. They use that color blocking technique to kind of make video looking things. They're kind of rotoscoped.
Yeah.
I'm sure our listeners have heard about that series before, so I'll just say I saw some illustrations of Mulder and Scully from the X-Files online the other day, and they look like the flashback cutscene style, and I was like, can you imagine a 16-bit flashback-style game with the X-Files characters? The end.
Damn.
What we could have had.
Is that boring? I'll cut this out. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody.
No, keep it in. We loved it.
No, no, it's okay. We don't have to do this. All right, are we done? Let's.
Yeah, I think unless we want to talk about that pizza contest.
Oh, the pizza.
I'm kind of okay.
The Domino's. You want to talk about Domino's. The Domino's pizza contest?
No, I mean.
All right. Well, let's leave this in so people be like, "What's he talking about?" And now I'm curious.
This is just way back when Domino's used to like suck, right? Domino's was like the bad pizza at this point.
I mean, still the bad one, but really? I love it. I guess they've improved.
I like Domino's. I don't know that means it's good, but I like it.
I mean, I like Little Caesars. I'll eat some Little Caesars. Hot some crazy bread.
Domino's thin crust, though.
The what?
Mm.
The Domino's thin crust.
Yeah. It's like excellent, more garlicky now, right?
This is a Pizza Hut household over here for some reason.
I hate Pizza Hut.
What?
I hate.
How dare you?
I hate Pizza Hut.
There is one thing we missed also besides flashback in the Pack Watch that I need to talk about. This is in my notes. I pointed out this is the first Pack Watch that mentions the Charles Barkley partnership, which is how we got Barkley Shut Up and Jam, which is, of course, the prequel to the indie game Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden, which Carrie's nodding at. That makes me super excited. Can we talk about, Carrie, do you want to explain what this is?
It's like, I don't think I can. I just love that it exists.
It's like, so it's an RPG maker game, right? Like so it's like a 16-bit thing that uses assets from Barkley Shut Up and Jam and a bunch of other stuff. And it stars Charles Barkley in like a dystopian sci-fi world. And it's part of the Hoops Barkley saga. And they did a sequel to that because his son is Hoops Barkley. And in this world, the events of Space Jam are real, like the original Michael Jordan Space Jam. And Charles Barkley did I feel like I'm not explaining it. I'm just rattling off all the stuff I love about it. So I'm going to keep going. Charles Barkley did a thing called a chaos dunk, which destroyed New York City. So they're in Neo New York City.
That's great.
And as a result of the chaos dunk, basketball is illegal. But because it's 16-bit RPG text rules, like we talked about in Secret of Mana, they have to call it B-ball in all the text boxes. And Michael Jordan is the leader of the secret police to make sure that nobody plays basketball.
B-ball.
B-ball. Sorry. Yes, B-ball.
I try to play more of those like silly indie games. I feel like I need to get more of those under my...
Carrie, can you think of any other funny bits from that game? Because I know I didn't get them all.
No, I cannot.
All right.
Okay, well, we did it. We're done.
That's the magazine.
Hell yeah. All right. Cool. Well, we dissected it all.
Usually at the end, we would rate something about the Nestor comic, but I guess... Our ratings have to do with pizza joints, pizza franchises. If you had to open a pizza franchise, which one would it be? But I think we already answered our questions. Because Brett, you hate Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Carrie, you like Domino's, and I love Pizza Hut.
So I'm just hatred over here. I only.
But what rating would you give your favorite pizza chain out of 10?
10. I mean, here's the thing. Even
Domino's gets a 10 out of 10.
Even a pizza that's not great, it's still pizza. Like,
okay.
I feel like you have to try hard to really do a bad pizza. It's cheese, it's bread, maybe a little pepperoni. You can't go wrong.
I feel ashamed because I was going to give Pizza Hut a solid 4 out of 10. So maybe it is actually bad. I don't know. But like, I love, Pizza Hut's delicious. They put well, they don't do this anymore. Maybe I should deduct a point. They used to be able to say what kind of seasoning that you wanted sprinkled on the crust around the edge of the pizza. So you could do Hut's favorite, and it's just, I don't know, oregano and Parmesan and a bunch of stuff. Yum. Anyways, they don't do that anymore, so 3 out of 10.
Damn. Okay. Well, Carrie, thanks so much for joining us. It was really
Brett,
cool.
You don't want to rate. You don't want to rate your pizza place of choice. We don't have to.
Domino's would probably be my favorite of like the quick ones, of the cheap, like mega brands, and I would probably give it a 8 out of 10.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Yep. So yes, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, where can people find you? What do you want to plug?
Oh goodness. Not plugging a whole lot just yet, but I don't even think I've been on Twitter in a long time. Now it's X, right? But occasionally I'm there.
Gross. Yeah. Ugh,
X. Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. When I'm there, I'm Carrie_Patel. But I am not there often these days.
I mean, people can check out you worked on what part of the Outer Worlds? It was the DLC, right?
I wrote for the base game, and then I directed the DLC Peril on Gorgon. So yeah, if you're looking for something to play, check those out.
That's amazing.
And if you like the adventure games we're talking about, our studio released Pentiment not long ago. Ooh. And that is a delightful game. So check that one out too.
Pentiment is so cool. Like, they're speaking of games, like, it's not like Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden, but there's also nothing quite like it. So I put it in the same category. Wait, can you pitch Pentiment to people who haven't heard of it?
So it is a murder mystery set in a medieval monastery. It's about history and how we remember it, how we change it, how we move through it. And it's a really wonderful, thoughtful story that kind of spans a period of time for some characters in this small village in Germany around an abbey, and the way that murders and the events around them kind of shape their lives.
That's cool. So cool. It's also done in the art style of old monastic, like calligraphy and stuff, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Illustrations.
It looks like an illuminated manuscript. The illustrations are gorgeous, and there's some, I don't know, there's some really lovely little touches, like the way the characters talk. It's their little speech bubbles pop up with different text fonts that are kind of indicative of kind of their station, their level of education. So you've got kind of monks speaking with these very ornate letters.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
The printer awesome. And his family, they speak with like these sort of print block letters. It's wonderful. Cool. There's so many delightful details there.
Damn.
Wait, can we just like talk about cool Obsidian games? Can we talk about Grounded? Or should we? You just leave it there. Play Grounded. Also, play Pentiment. Now You're Playing with Podcast is brought to you by the Podcast Power Players Power Team. Music by Games Cameron. Find back episodes, send us emails, and do cool stuff at our website, nowyourplaying.com. That's your with an E, because we know how to do grammar.